Good morning, everyone. How many are here at the Feast of Tabernacles for the first time? Can I see your hand? Oh, we do have a few. Well, I want to welcome y'all, and I hope you have a great feast. Now for the next part. I hope we don't have any Hillary supporters here. Because I'm from Arkansas. You know, when Bill Clinton was governor in Arkansas, he was known as a ladies' man. He was quite a womanizer. And him and Hillary had some pretty good brawls in the White House. Not the White House, but the state mansion there. And I'm sure they did in the White House also. One night, Hillary comes in about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and she goes up to the bedroom. There's this nightlight at the end of the bed, and it shows off enough glow that all she could see was 4 feet sticking out from under the covers on the bed. Well, no, she's a pretty mean woman. She's pretty hot-headed. She storms out of the bedroom and opens the closet door and brings in a ball bat. She takes that ball bat and she starts waylaying. All you could hear was moans and groans under the cover. She goes out and walks down in the kitchen. Bill's sitting there. He said, "Well, hi, honey." Said, "Your mom and dad flew in to stay a few nights. They up in the bedroom." Said, "Did you go up and see them?" Oh. In a conversation with Jesus Christ, his disciples ask him a question. In Luke 17, he asked, "Will you give us more faith? Increase our faith." If you want to, turn to Luke 17th chapter. Luke 17, verse 5, "And the apostles said unto the eternal, increase our faith. And the Lord said, if you had faith as a grain of a mustard seed, you could say unto the sycamore tree, be plucked up by the roots and be planted by the sea, and it would obey." You know, I confess, there's been times when I felt like I needed more faith. There's been times when I felt like I needed faith as huge as a mountain. But a tiny mustard seed. How big is that, brother? But that small amount of faith is only half of the equation, small or large. Because you see, if you combine that faith with perseverance, great zeal, it can move sycamore trees. It can heal the sick. It can raise the dead. Our God in heaven expects us to use what we have been given, great or small. Because you see, it's actually not our faith, it's the faith of Jesus Christ. He's the one that gives us the faith. But we have to combine that with the right character. If you would turn to Hebrews 11, verse 6. And we've all heard this verse many times throughout the years in God's church. Hebrews 11, verse 6. "But without faith it is impossible to please Him. For he that comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of them." Pay close attention to this word here, diligently seek Him. Do we diligently seek our God, the faith that we need? Faith, belief, diligence as a human being, that's what we got to have. It's got to be a combination. Because you see, we can quit doing anything. We're free moral agents. We can quit believing anything. For those of you who go back to the days of the parent organization, the great falling away. What about those people, brother? Did they have faith at some point in time? Did they believe? Did they know God's truth? Yes, they did. Can you lose what God has given us? Yes, we can. It can be taken away. Satan can take anything away from us, brother, if we don't hold on. If you would turn to Luke 18. Luke 18. Jesus Christ gave another parable of the widow. Luke 18, verse 3. And there was a widow in the city, and she came unto him, she came unto an unjust judge, saying, "Help me, avenge me against my adversary." Verse 4. And he would not for a while, but later he said within himself, "Though I fear not God, nor regard men." In verse 5, "Because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she wearies me." You know, folks, unjust judge is no different from what we got today. Talk to anybody that's had any dealings with the court. Lawyers. Hope nobody's a lawyer out here, because they're not really my favorite type of people. Can you get justice in the world courts today, especially in this nation? Probably very seldom. You see, this unjust judge didn't have no concern for the widow or her plight, her situation. He didn't care about that. The man had no empathy, didn't care about right and wrong. You know, for him, she was just a bother, a nuisance. And he only avenged her because she pestered him. The Bible doesn't say how many times she came to this unjust judge. We don't know. But folks, that woman was like a bulldog. You know, when a bulldog latches on to something, they don't let go. That's perseverance. That's determination. So let me ask this question. What accomplishment could you and I, as God's people, what could we achieve if we combine a small amount of faith, the size of a mustard seed, and we had this widow's type of zeal, diligence, determination? What could you and I do? And I honestly say, because it's not getting any easier in this world, I hope that it will take us into God's kingdom, brother.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Happy Feast of Tabernacles. It's hard to believe that another year has passed, isn't it? We just, the year seemed to fly by anymore. It's hard to believe that I'm as old as I am, but I'm getting up there now. Every year before the feast, I always look with anticipation on the website to try and see if Dr. Ricks has posted the speaking schedule every year, and I think most of the speakers do the same thing. It's with a little bit of anxiety and trepidation that we look to see what kind of an assignment that we have been given, whether it's a sermon, sermonette, offering, Bible study, whatever it is. And I think all of the speakers take these assignments very seriously. And we do tend to worry about them and wonder, we're constantly praying, what is it, Father in heaven, that you want us to deliver this year? Because after all, that's what we're doing. As ministers, we are servants of Jesus Christ. That's what the term a minister means, is servant. And so we worry about them. And we always hope and that God will inspire us as to what he wants us to do. And it amazes me every year how everything comes together. I didn't know what I was going to talk about until the last couple of days. And I know Mr. Armstrong always told us to try and have our sermon pretty well ready a couple of months in advance. And there have been times that I've done that. But occasionally, it's almost a last-minute thing. I have all of these ideas swirling around in my head, and slowly they sort of coalesce into something that I want to talk about. And that's what happened this year. You know, we live in an age where there is no accountability. We see law-breaking at all levels of government. We see people who don't want to follow the rules, and they don't want any consequences for that. So it makes life much more difficult. As I was growing up in the 50s, I pretty well knew what the rules were. I knew how to make it in life, I think. Because my parents divorced when I was very young, I was pretty much left to myself, and I learned how to get along in life. Did a lot of foolish things, but nonetheless, eventually it all came together, and I knew how to get along in life and to sort of be successful. But today that's not the case at all. There are no rules anymore, and nobody wants to be held accountable. So we have to ask ourselves the question, is there anything that we can count on? What can we count on? I'd like to begin in Romans 1. Romans 1 and verse 29. It describes what people are going to be like in this age that we're living in now. It says in verse 29, it is talking about this present time, and it says, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, deceitful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, deceitful, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God, they know in the back of their minds that there are penalties for what they are doing, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. So they gather around people who of like mind, people who tend to think that the same way, to be just like what we just read. So we have to ask ourselves the question, okay, how do we get by in this age? Because we have specific instructions that are given to us as to how we are to live our life. Turn to Matthew 4 and verse 18. This is an interesting scripture, and it kind of sets the theme for what I want to talk about today. Matthew 4 and verse 18, this is the point where Jesus is just beginning his ministry, and he's going around and selecting his disciples. In verse 18 it says, and Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brethren, Simon called Peter and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers. And he said unto them, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. And they straightway left their nets and followed him. In verse 21, and going on from thence, he saw two brethren, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in a ship with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets, and he called them, and they immediately left the ship and their father and followed him. So when you first read this, it's as though he's just walking around the countryside and says, hey, I've got this great idea, come follow me. And these were people that he just selected randomly. But that's not the case at all. He knew these people. He grew up with them. They had probably had many discussions over the years. They either knew or strongly suspected that he was the Messiah, the prophesied one to come. So it's not at all like it seems to appear here. These were people that he had had long discussions with in the past about the kingdom of God and about what was going to happen in the future. So they readily got up and followed him. They were probably saying things to themselves like, well, finally we're going to do something. You know, we've been talking about this for years. It was interesting. I oftentimes am amazed that the songs that we end up singing, how well they fit in with the sermon of that day. And it's interesting that we sang today the song, Wherever He Leads, I'll Go, because that's what I'm talking about. Christ said, follow me. And he said that directly to the disciples, but in a way, he's saying that to all of us. In another place, he said, elaborates on the same concept of follow me. And he said to them all, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life, or it means to give up their present life and do what he says, will save it. For my sake, the same shall save it. And it's interesting when some of the Bible commentators have mentioned that what he's talking about here, the way he phrases this, is something that the disciples were already familiar with. Israel had the certain procedure that if you were a Gentile and from one of the Gentile nations and you wanted to become an Israelite, you could. But there were certain criteria that you had to follow in order to do that. And that's what is bound up in this brief statement here. Notice the first criteria was that it had to be voluntary. You couldn't do it because your wife or your husband wanted you to do it. You couldn't do it for any other reason than the fact that this is something you really wanted to do. And that's what he says here, if any man shall come after me. And then the second thing, it says, let him deny himself. Well, what that really means was what they had to do was turn away from their old gods, because most of the Gentile nation worshipped many, many so-called gods. They had to agree to turn away from that. And then the third thing was, and take up his cross daily. And what that really means is you had to be willing to accept whatever consequences came along for you obeying God's law. You had to be willing to follow the law that God laid out in the commandments. And you had to be willing to just accept whatever comes along as a consequence of that. Today we see that most prominently in keeping of the Sabbath. Almost every business owner expects you to be willing to work on the Sabbath day. And that's one of the things that we bump up against a lot as after we come into an understanding of the truth. We have to go to our employer and just tell them, I'm not going to work on Saturdays anymore. And oftentimes that results in a loss of the job. So that's what it means by taking up your cross. And then the fourth thing was follow me. And the way the commentators describe that is Christ, we follow Christ. Christ was faithful unto death. So there's no turning back. If you wanted to become an Israelite, you were making a lifelong commitment. So that's what it's talking about here. So we can see that the term follow me requires a real commitment, doesn't it? Let's take a look at someone who made that commitment, although we don't read about that actually happening. And then turn to Job 1 and verse 1. I don't like to read the middle of this book. I like the first few chapters and I like the last few chapters. But it gets pretty tedious through the middle. It just seems like poor Job's trial goes on and on forever. But in verse 1 it says, "In the land of Uz there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright." And this is from the New International Version. "He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons, 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep." And it goes on to explain that he was a very wealthy man. He was one of the wealthiest men in the world at that time. And it says in verse 4, "His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays." And that's what the King James doesn't mention that. It just says on their day. But that's most commentators believe that's what it was. And they would invite 3 sisters to eat and drink with him. Not that there's anything wrong with observing birthdays, although Worldwide did teach that at one time. "When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, 'Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' This was Job's regular custom." So he was very diligent in following the laws concerning the sacrifices and that sort of thing. That's what it means when he said that he was, in the King James, it says he was perfect. He really wasn't, but that's what it was. He followed those ritualistic laws perfectly. And then jump ahead to, and we know what happens during that time. Of course, in the next few verses, we read about how Job loses his whole family. He loses all his wealth. He loses everything except his wife, who, in the midst of all this, says, "Why don't you just curse God and get this over with and die?" So much for standing by your man, right? So when he hears the latest news in verse 20, he says, At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground to worship and said, Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." And in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. And I can't remember, how does the King James phrase that? To charge God foolishly, I believe it says. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what Job did not do. He did not charge God foolishly. And he didn't even complain. Really, he didn't even complain about the trial he was enduring. And do we sometimes charge God foolishly? Do we sometimes, when we're trying to tell someone that we'd like for them to pray for us, we just say things like, "This just goes on, and I don't know how much more I can take. It's just, I've prayed about it, and I've fasted about it, and I just can't take it anymore." And I have to ask myself, what are we doing when we do that? Isn't that sort of a verbalization of the lack of faith when we do that? I mean, when you understand, it's in James 1 where it says, "Count it all joy when you fall into various trials." You know, wouldn't it be a whole lot better to say, "Man, I know God is working with me because I have this terrible trial, and I know there's something that I'm going to learn from this trial, and I'm so thankful that God is working this in me so that I can be more like Jesus Christ on the other side of this trial. And I know that He's promised to deliver me from every trial, so I have that to look forward to." See, it's all kind of a matter of how you look at it. And when you understand what Christ said about the Israelites, about them murmuring in the wilderness, that's really, they were just complaining constantly about their situation. So I think we have to be careful about how we handle things like that. (Clears throat) But I think that our trials are rather tame, rather pale in comparison to the trial that Job was having, having lost everything that he had, all of his physical wealth, having lost all of his children. It must have been a horrible burden on him. So where did Job get the faith that he obviously had to not even question why he was in a trial of such magnitude, or even ask when it was going to end? Where did he come up with the faith for that? Well, I think we have several, we have some hints throughout the Bible as to how one of the things that we can do to try and increase our faith. We know faith comes from God, and faith comes from God's Word. So let's take a look at a couple of places. In Job 38 and verse 37, I'm just going to read this quickly. You don't have to turn there. He says, Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? And David said in Psalms 19, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. So we have to ask ourselves, who was the being that created all of that? I know, like me, many of you probably like to watch these shows about space and about the Hubble telescope and the discoveries and things that are out there. I certainly do. I really enjoy watching that because it just never ceases to amaze me how much, how large, how unbelievably large the universe is, and how all of that's out there for us to just get a glimpse of. I know as a kid I used to look up at the sky and I think, what is really out there and how far does it go? Is there something on the other side of the universe, if the universe has an end? And it's just fascinating when you understand the immense size and power and energy that's locked up out there. So let's take a look at creation here real quick. First of all, let's start with our solar system. We think of our solar system as being this huge, massive entity that's out there. It consists of the Sun and Mercury, Mars, Venus, the Earth. I've got them all written down here because I knew I was going to forget them. Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, and Pluto. Although this Pluto as a planet is now in question, I guess. As well as several moons, asteroids, and comets. That makes up our solar system. It sounds like a lot of material, but do you realize that 99.8% of the mass of our solar system is tied up in our sun? In fact, some of these astronomers have described our solar system as the sun and a little bit of debris. You know, all of the planets and the moons and everything else are just insignificant. They only make up 0.2% of the solar system. Our sun is so massive. And I could talk a lot about our planet when you understand Earth sciences and how everything works together on this planet, how everything is just interdependent, how well designed it is. It's just amazing. I could talk for hours on that. You remember Carl Sagan and his show Cosmos? He used to say that there's only one thing that's required to have life on a planet, and that is it has to be the right distance from a star, from a sun. Well, after he died, various astronomers began to take issue with that, and they said, well, you know, there are other conditions that have to exist. It has to be basically a water planet. It has to be covered mostly with water, which the Earth is. And then they started describing all these other things. It has to rotate a certain speed. When they got up to about 300 different things that are required for a planet to sustain life, not even create, have life spontaneously appear on it as they think it happens, but to sustain life, many of these astrophysicists began to say, you know, life on forming on a planet is virtually impossible. And, you know, we know that that's true. We know that life doesn't just automatically appear out of nowhere. Life requires a life giver. And slowly, it's interesting when you begin to study these things, many of these astronomers are coming to the realization that what we've been saying about creation all along is true. But back to the sun for a moment. It is huge. It's hard to believe how big the sun is, because when we look out there, it looks like it's about the same size as the moon. And the moon is just a fraction of the size of the sun. But the sun is so much further away. It is 865,938 miles in diameter. That's the distance across it if you're looking at the face of the moon. You could line up 109 Earths across the face of the moon. It is 93 million miles from Earth. It takes about 8 minutes for light traveling at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, to reach the Earth. It is 2,713,406 miles in circumference. It would take 1.3 million Earths to fill the space that the moon has, or that the sun has. And it's only a very average-sized star. And, you know, when you read these things, you have to ask yourself, where did this come from? Who made that? Who put that out there? It's the same being who said to you and me, follow me. Currently, the largest known star as of February of this year is believed to be a star called R136A1. It is estimated to be approximately 13 million miles across. That's the diameter of it. If you were to reduce it to the size of, say, a basketball and place our sun beside it, you wouldn't even be able to see our sun. It would be so tiny. It would be microscopic. If you inflated it to a ball about the size of, say, 8 or 10 feet in diameter, you might just barely be able to see our sun if you place it next to it. That's just to give you a comparison of the size of them. And then recently I typed into my search engine, how big is the universe? And various things came up. One of them said that it was, I think, 76 billion light years across. And then I read another one that made it even bigger. And then another one said, some of the astronomers said, it may very well be that it is infinite, that there is no end to it. And the Hubble telescope has kind of verified that. You know, it's given us some amazing pictures and some unbelievable information about our solar system. A few years ago, they pointed the Hubble telescope at a dark place in the sky. And the way they described it was that if you took a soda straw and held it up and looked through it, that was about the size of the area they were looking at. And they pointed the Hubble telescope at that, and they opened the aperture on it and left it open for 10 days in hopes that if there was anything out there, it would register on the receiver plate. When they finally closed the aperture and looked to see what was there, there were 10,000 tiny dots of light. And they were not stars. They were galaxies. There were 10,000 galaxies in that very tiny area of the sky. Each one of those galaxies probably had in the neighborhood of 100 billion stars in them. And that was, that was just in an area that was dark in the sky. We don't know what's beyond that. We don't. It very well could be that the universe is infinite. After all, you know, God said, of the increase of his kingdom, there shall be no end. This earth is only going to hold so many people. And beyond that, who knows what God has in mind for us. I'm sure he didn't put those billions of stars out there and all of those galaxies that we can't even see. There has to be a reason for them to be there. So we have to ask ourselves, when we look at all that, as I did as a child, was who made that? Who did that? Who put all that out there? That didn't just happen. The laws of physics tell us that that's not going to just happen. Energy can't be destroyed and it can't be created. It just changes to a different form. It doesn't come out of nowhere. And when you take a sun that is 13 million miles across, can you imagine the amount of energy that is locked up in there? That energy had to come from somewhere. But you might say, well, that's fine and dandy, but how does that affect me? You know, let's get back down to earth and see what God has done, you know, can or will do for me, or in this case, has done in the past. I always like to go to the book of Exodus and read about Israel leaving Egypt. And it's always interesting, the parallels between them coming out of Egypt and our coming out of sin, coming out of the world, as we call it, the world's way, because there's so many parallels involved there. Did you ever stop to think about what it takes to provide for a group of people that large? It's estimated by most commentators that there's somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million people that left Egypt. Well, you've got to feed them. You've got to provide them with water. You know, you have to provide them with fuel to do their cooking. There's just so much that has to be done. And I've seen some of these estimates before, and some of them were pretty fantastic. But I did my calculations myself. I got online and I said, how much food does the average person consume each day? And the consensus seemed to be that it's somewhere worldwide, it's somewhere around 5.5 pounds of food a day is what people are eating now. Maybe we don't require that much, but that's what we're eating at this point. So 5.5 pounds of food per day, you know what that relates to? I didn't know how much weight a railroad boxcar would hold. But the Union Pacific sets their limit, I believe it's 268,000 pounds. And they do that because some of the bridges won't handle any more weight than that. By the time you add the weight of the car, it's up over 300,000, about 315,000 pounds per car. Well, 5.5 pounds of food per day for 2.5 to 3 million people requires 61 fully loaded boxcars every day. Can you imagine having to do that? As if I was given the assignment to take care of that many people, it would be impossible for us to do it. And how about water? The average, according to what I found on the internet, is it takes about 7.5 liters of water per day. And I don't know if that includes washing your dishes and that sort, or your clothes and that sort of thing. But even at that, you would have to have a source of water that's about 7.5 liters. It's roughly two gallons per person. So you're looking at somewhere between 5 and 6 million gallons a day. That's 250,000 gallons per hour, running 24 hours a day, 4,200 gallons per minute, or 70 gallons a second. So when the water flowed out from the rock, this wasn't just a little trickle. This was a massive flow. A few years ago, we had a family reunion down at Big Spring near Van Buren, Missouri. And if you've ever seen that, it's just mind-boggling how that much water can come out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The flow varies a little, but it's still a massive amount of water. It is the headwater for the Spring River, and it's unbelievable how much water is coming out. This had to have been a massive flow because these calculations assume that you use every drop of the water that's coming out, and we know that wouldn't be possible. That would require 230,000 gallon tank cars per day, minimum. That's the absolute minimum. Again, I checked on the internet, and most tank cars hold about 30,000 gallons. Again, it has to do with the weight more than anything else. So why do we even know about the Exodus? Why do we have a whole book about the Exodus? And I suspect that it has to do with God showing us that He will take care of us in any situation, because He placed Israel in an impossible situation. And another thing to consider about the Exodus is recently we just got here, and I turned on the TV, and there was the modern version of Exodus. It was called Exodus, Gods and something else, Gods and Kings or something like that. And, of course, it was all messed up. There wasn't anything really that followed the narrative in the Bible, but it changed everything all around and didn't really demonstrate how that God had done all this. Moses, when you think about it, I'm not even going to talk about that because it was so wrong, but what did the Israelites have to do in order to get out of slavery? If something they wanted to do, what did they have to do? They didn't rise up and rebel. They didn't have a civil war and overcome Pharaoh or anything like that. No, God took care of all that. He provided Moses and Aaron, and they went before Pharaoh. And when he said no, then God provided the plagues that finally convinced Pharaoh, after the death of the firstborn, to let them go. In fact, they were practically shoving them out of Egypt. Here, take this. You need anything, go ahead and take it. We want you out of here before we're all dead. So what did the Israelites have to do? They only had to do one thing, and that's start walking. They had to walk to the promised land. That was all that God required of them. And when you think about it, I mean, I look back over my life, and I think, you know, that's really all I had to do was just keep on going. And in fact, in Revelation 3 and verse 10, you know, it tells us to overcome and to endure. That's really, it talks a lot about enduring. He who endures unto the end shall, and then tells you about, in various of those verses, the rewards that we're going to reap. And I certainly think that the book of Exodus is there to help us to be convinced, to increase our faith, that God is going to take care of us, that we are on a journey, that where all we have to do is keep walking. Don't give up. Don't go off on a tangent. Don't let some unusual bit of doctrine that someone has that kind of tickles your intellect a little bit draw you away from the truth. Garner Ted Armstrong always said the way to determine whether or not someone's little, idea baby, whether or not it is accurate or not, is, he said, the process that we use is that we prove things. We start off and we prove the basics. We prove that the commandments are still in effect. We prove that we are to keep the Sabbath and various things like that. And it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You have this one piece about the law, and then you have another piece about something else, and those pieces all fit together. And pretty soon you build up this picture like you do when you're putting together a jigsaw puzzle, and all of a sudden you get a piece that doesn't fit anywhere. It just won't fit in with what you've already proven. You toss that piece because it's probably not right. It's not correct. But I want to conclude now. This thing that Christ said, follow me, that's what you and I are doing. We are following Jesus Christ. We answered the call when Christ said, follow me. And we have all come voluntarily. No one forced us to do it. In fact, I think in most cases we could not follow God, follow Christ. I think we just felt like it was something we had to do, and oftentimes it was painful. We've denied ourselves. We've turned from our old ways. Some of us grew up in various Protestant churches. Some were Catholics. Some really didn't have much in the way of religious beliefs at all. We've put all that behind us. We denied ourselves. And then we have taken up our cross and borne the burden of being different, just as Christ did. You know, even today in many of the Jewish communities, they joke about Jesus Christ being an illegitimate child. I won't use the word that they generally describe him with. And I'm sure growing up, he probably bore that burden himself. So we bear the burden of being different. You know, as soon as we tell people that we attend church on Saturday, it kind of raises eyebrows. And I know my daughter Crystal has a job where the business is open on Saturday, and they're constantly asking her, well, can't you do it just this one time? And they just don't understand the level of commitment that's required for us to obey God. we have endured the persecution of a world that does not understand what real commitment is, because you see so little of it today. We've kept the commitment we made at baptism, and we are still here following Christ to the promised land, following the incredible being who made all of the amazing creation we see, and much more that we can't even see. That wonderful elder brother we call Jesus Christ, who one day said to each of us, "Follow me." So I hope that each one of us here has a safe journey, continue to overcome, continue to endure, and I can't wait to see each one of you as brothers and sisters in Christ in the family of God.